Hello and welcome to Dynasty As They Want to Be, a podcast where we drill into every episode of the iconic 1980s television series Dynasty. I'm your host, Derek J. Lang, and returning with me is my co-host and husband, Kyler K. Jafari.
It's me, I'm back.
Oh, you were so missed. That was the first episode that you didn't appear on.
I were not missed.
Yeah, you were. Yeah, you was.
You packed two microphones on purpose. You knew this was all premeditated.
Oh, we're going to go there, huh? Mm-hmm.
We just went there.
Well, how did you think Omar Barragán did?
Well, you know, season's greetings to Omar. I wish I could have been there. But I can't believe you standard sluts were eating cannoli from Italy.
Okay, obviously that's not my favorite cannoli, but I was pressed for time. And I wanted a cannoli.
Tell that to any New Yorker.
Well,
pressed for time.
I couldn't make it down to the East Village to Venero's, which is the best cannoli in New York City. Well, in Manhattan, the best cannoli in Brooklyn is Court Street Pastry. But anyway, I was near Italy. I popped in. I was pressed for time. I was running around like a crazy person. So quit coming for me on all fronts. You think I'm trying to replace you on Dynasty As They Want to Be, and then I'm choosing bad cannoli? Like, it's not nice.
I feel like I've been canceled.
You haven't been canceled. If anything, you have been picked up for another season, because we have an amazing cocktail to sip on while we talk about this week's episode. Tell the darlings what you've made for us.
Well, tonight we wound up at the St. Denis Club again, the only place to eat lunch in the whole town of Denver.
It's so
and
true.
Naturally, Dame Joan Collins, aka Alexis Carrington, orders up one of my faves, which is the Cure Royale. It's pretty much a brunch to tea time drink, and
yeah,
it's a little late
her,
to be having this, but that's fine.
I think her and Fallon were just having lunch, and she just wanted a champagne cocktail.
It's a sort of way to have champagne without having champagne. It's also a good way to, like,
mask shitty champagne.
Dose up some not so hot champagne. So yeah, Prosecco even, clutch your pearls. It's a dash of crème de cassis, which is a specialty of Dijon. Although I think there's plenty of places in France and outside of the continent that make it. Anyway, its only other use apparently is on vanilla ice cream as like a sort of substitute for syrup.
Okay, well, can we have that after we're done recording?
Yeah, I mean, because I got a whole bottle of this shit lying around for the last 5 years. I don't know what else I'm going to do with it.
Well, cheers to my return and your return and not being canceled. And
chin chin, darling.
Delicious. I ended up having a fabulous time in New York. I saw lots of old friends, reconnected, and I did have one night to myself where I kind of went a little crazy. I went and had a ramen by myself, and then I went to go see Moulin Rouge on Broadway, which I know we talked about several episodes ago.
Oh, this is too crazy. No, come on.
It was actually really great, and I loved it. Two thumbs up, A+.
Thumbs up where?
Well, you can.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
No, it was way better than the movie because everybody could sing. They did an amazing job with the production.
We already know my thoughts about the movie.
Immaculate.
It could only be better than whatever the movie was.
Yeah, I mean, the bar was like pretty low. Was the
bar themed?
There was a bar on the stage, and then there was a bar in the lobby.
Love a musical stage productions have like a bar and it's themed.
Right, and then you can actually like get service from the
bar. Like Patti LuPone's going to pour me a Mexican train wreck.
That would be amazing. I bet Patti LuPone makes a stiff cocktail. No, they have like the seating kind of like, I feel like Cabaret when they revived Cabaret like what, 20 or 30 years ago.
Talk about the one with Alan Cummings.
Yeah, yeah. The one that they did at Studio 54 originally. They had like bar seating. I think that's like a thing now that, you know, productions do. So they do have...
We gotta put asses in bar stools, you know?
They do have seats in the front, but I actually would not... I actually had a partial view. That's what it was considered seat, and it was, like, I got
that
all
the means, like,
the
men's
views.
Room door is in front of your face, or...
Yeah, which is, like, great. I would have paid extra for that.
Hot ticket.
No, but I was, like, I was underneath the windmill. There's, like, a giant elephant, you know, which is where Nicole Kidman's character, Satine... That's where her dressing room is. So there's, like, a giant elephant. There's a giant windmill. It was, yeah, it was just really fabulous. And what I loved about it is, so it's all, like, the pop music, just like the original, but it's different music. So now you have your Katy Perry and your Lady Gagas and your Bruno Mars. But the way they arrange it is so interesting. And it's just like...
I would take the Police and Madonna over all of that, though.
Well, there's definitely Madonna. I can't remember if there's Police. There's just so much music. And you know what? I realized I was looking for clips of it on YouTube. And the reason that there's no clips, because I'm sure the rights...
Scrubbed.
It's for this musical are so expensive because they use like 100 pop songs. It's crazy.
Yeah, you ain't gonna find that on YouTube's.
Yeah, so I don't think they're doing a lot of performances. Plus, they want, you know, to get those asses on the bar stools when they're selling tickets for like $200, $300, $400. But it was a good time. I highly recommend. Fabulous costumes. If you love Dynasty, you'll love Moulin Rouge on Broadway because it's just over the top glamour.
That sounds like a broad brush stroke, but sure.
Yeah.
I was listening to yours and Omar's you know, repartee, and I have to kind of agree with both of you. You're both right about Claudia. She is over Steven, but she's not over him, right? Like, she's I thought it was, you both kind of took both sides of that argument. And I think you were both correct.
I think the jury's still out. I'm going to need to see Claudia and Steven in a scene together.
No, I think for Claudia, she's hearkening back to a past life, I think almost literally. I swear to God, Claudia has been reincarnated in season two, and she's not even the same character.
You keep saying that. She is the same character. She wants her daughter. I mean, she's evolving. People change, but she is the same character. I don't think they've... mind wiped her, Men in Black her brain or anything.
I just think that she associates Steven with a past life, and I don't think it's so much that they're gonna have something or that she wants to have something. I think it's more, it's a pang of nostalgia almost, and it sort of ties back to her obsession with finding Matthew and Lindsay. Which, of course, like, that gets played up in this episode, so
I know. Let's talk about it. Yeah, that's pretty intense stuff. Guess let's just take a break and we'll get into this week's episode, Blake's Blindness. Welcome back. Well, I mean, this is just Blake's episode. Like, everything literally has to do with Blake, what's going on with Blake.
I feel like the whole damn show is Blake's show.
It really is. So, he's blind now.
No, I meant Dynasty. Dynasty is Blake's show.
Oh.
Whether we like it or not.
Well, I guess you must be in John Forsythe's corner.
Well, no, but I mean, okay, so this episode starts out, right, with this, like, totally OTT... blind man's bluff, like, ridiculous character acting.
Okay, so let's talk about
ultra campy
John Forsythe's blind acting. Okay, let me just give you the pros and cons. Okay,
well, do we have a lot of, like, comparisons for blind acting? I feel like there must be, but it's not coming to mind.
Well, we only talk about Dynasty on this podcast, so I'm not going to compare him to...
Well, I'm just saying. I mean, if we're going to complain about his performance, then who shall we hold up as
Can
the
I just
standard?
Say what I was going to say? I was about to list pros and cons, okay? These are my pros and cons with John Forsythe's blind acting. Pro. He does a nice job of not looking directly at the other actors or whatever, even though he has vision. Con, when he's reaching for things that he can't see, he's feeling around the room like he's never been in these rooms before.
It's pretty bad, yeah.
Like, this character is in his bedroom. It's in his office. Like, he's not going to...
That slipper's 2 inches away from him.
Yeah, he's like going 4 feet into the corner reaching for a slipper. Like, it's not going to be that far away from the other slipper, bro. Like,
but what I think is like so stupid is like all the dialogue is like people keep saying things like, oh, I can see that, or you can see, or it's, and it's like it's always implied, well, no, actually he can't see, like literally he cannot, you know?
Well,
and that's even called Blake's blindness.
You can kind of tell. I think some of the actors were like snickering about this whole situation. Like there's one shot where John James
broke character.
Oh, I think John James could, in that first scene where the whole family is gathered in the bedroom and he's just in a rage, like breaking vases and turning tables over. I feel like John James is like trying to hold back a snicker. Like he's a SNL, you know, host laughing at a skit or something. It's pretty comical.
Well, at this point John James is canceled, so like he can do whatever he wants. Like,
I'm not canceling John James.
How many are you here in this room right now? What is this, an exhibition? Come and look at the blind man. Come and see what the blind man does. See how he rages in his blindness.
Okay, everybody out. Can't you see how upset he is? You too, Joseph, please.
I mean, if Blake wasn't already like a big asshole anyway, this like blindness has sent him over the edge. He's like yelling at the family. He's yelling at Crystal. He's yelling at Dr. Toscani. He's yelling at the preeminent specialist for blindness. Like, he's so pissed. He's also yelling at Joseph, the bitchy butler, who's apparently like wiping his ass and giving him blowjobs in the middle of the night.
It's like everything with Blake. He's this like mirror through which we see characters and how they respond. Blindness can either be a way for you to pander and expect people to treat you differently, or it can be a way to just make you a complete total asshole and be pissed off that you can't see and you already got a power issue. That's clearly like what's going on with Blake here. Like he's just like, he's already got authority problems, and now that he can't see, you know, he feels like he's being taken advantage of, and it just, you know, winds him up even more.
Yeah. Well, it's not winding Crystal up to go through with the divorce, which last week she said she's going to divorce him. And then he's blind, and now she's going to stick with him because she's Crystal.
Oh, this is like totally like the woman who won't leave. Like, this is her put. Like, oh, now he's blind. Okay, now I can extend that lease for a little while longer. Like, I'm not going to leave him until he can see. Which, like, she doesn't know if he's ever going to see her again or not. Like, so this is, like, typical Crystal.
Well,
locking herself up in the ivory tower, moping about how sad everything is in her life, even though, like she's surrounded by finery and glamorousness. And
well, can you please explain to me what the fuck is going on with Dr. Toscani and his relationship with Crystal? She clearly is not into him, and he is over the moon. And she even says by the end of the episode, can you help me? And he's like, yes, what can I do to help you? And she's like, leave me alone.
Yeah, I think he's got a little like Harvey Weinstein here. Like, he had his moment on the casting couch with her, and now like he expects all this other on the side, and she's like, no, no. And she's like dialing all that back, and now he's like raging about it, basically. Like, he's certainly exercising a male prerogative.
Oh, yeah. It's like totally misogynistic as fuck. And I feel bad for the poor thing because she's going through stuff with her husband and her personal life. And he's, I guess, the only person that she can turn to. All of her poor friends from the first season must be gone or something. And he's just taking advantage of her. And he is this authority figure because he is a psychiatrist. But in like a professional capacity, this is so wrong. So I'm canceling Dr. Nicholas Toscani. He's canceled.
Who's going to be left by the end of this episode? Like, everybody's kidding.
Alexis.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I do like the thing with Fallon, like trying to like sort of piece something back together with Jeff.
Oh, Jeff, let's not fight.
Then get dressed.
What, do I turn you off now that I'm pregnant?
No.
What's the matter then?
You're not doing this for me, you're doing it for Blake. Because I saved his life. And you figure you owe me something every once in a while.
Oh, now you're a mind reader.
And I like how, like, he just can't get that tie to tie. It's just not going to happen. Not she can get that tie to tie.
Yeah, no, they...
I feel like there's a metaphor there, and, like, it's pretty lazy and clumsy, but it's just, like, neither of the two of them can make this marriage work, you know? And yet, they're basically just sticking together for a baby, which is, like, maybe the worst reason for a married couple to stay married. I don't know.
Yo, honey, there's millions of married couples that have stayed together for a baby.
Maybe this is, like, you know, hard-hitting topics in the early 1980s.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm sure a lot of people was watching this shiz, and they were like, I feel that, mm-hmm. I feel that. But, no, I think Fallon is just trying to get into Jeff's pants because she uses sex to get what she wants. The great thing about it, though, is that Jeff sees through it, and he's just turning her down. I guess they're sleeping in, like, separate bedrooms now or something. So
Jeff is, like, this interesting sort of, like, minor Greek mythological character in a way, in the way that he knows and sees everything, but he's, like, totally irrelevant to what's going on and has, like, zero involvement in any of the action. So it's like, on the one hand, like, yeah, he knows that she's playing him, but then on the other hand,
he doesn't do anything about it.
There's nothing he can do about it. But this is what we keep complaining about with Jeff, right? I mean, and, you know, in some ways, like, I think he's sort of the prototype for, like, yuppie manhood in, like, 80s television.
Right. Like, what is the goal?
But at the same time, like, nobody thinks back to, like, the ideal of the yuppie and thinks of Jeff Colby because, like, he's got zero agency, and he's, like, exercises no utility.
Well, no, I think he does have agency. I just don't understand what he wants. Like, he doesn't really want to be married to Fallon. I mean, he did at one point.
Yeah, but that's because he's kind of like a kiss-ass, too, right?
He's a total kiss-ass.
He's, like, toadying up to Blake.
Yeah, my God, he jumped on top of him and possibly sacrificed his life for Blake's.
Well, at least in that sacrifice, what got burned was that old Lincoln limo. I'm so excited to see what Blake's going to be riding around in these days.
Oh, they're not just going to, like, take it to the auto body shop and fix it up?
No, that thing's a total loss. But it's interesting that we still get some of this interaction with the Logan Rynewood dude, like, sends his goons off again. Like, this weaselly snake guy keeps turning up.
Okay, well, don't spoil everything for me, but I have questions about Rynewood. So is this supposed to be, like, a mystery, like a Who Shot JR? Or we're all assuming that Rynewood sent his goons to throw dynamite at the car?
Yeah, this is, like, amateur hour mystery stuff. Like, they really didn't do a very good job of utilizing it, and I think the blind thing with Blake is already, like, so campy and ridiculous but fun, and this little storyline with Logan Rynewood, once you get to the bottom of this one, it is, like, I cannot roll my eyes enough. It is so hilarious, but I don't want to say too much.
In my crazy imagination, where I ride around on unicorns with a giant martini glass, I'm thinking, like, Rynewood is actually Alexis, and there's just this crazy subplot going on. But they're not giving me any breadcrumbs for me to go to, you know,
the audience
grandma's
is strictly
house.
Left there to dream up whatever could be there, because you're not getting anything here.
Yeah, I'm not getting any of that. So I'm not really sure which direction I'm supposed to be going. Like, if I'm supposed to be caring who actually threw the dynamite, you know, banning Rynewood's right hand, Sneaky Snake comes in and he's like, well, we have an alibi. It wasn't us and we're very sorry. And, you know, this is all to get a football team? Is this really...
Is this
worth
what goes
it?
On? Yeah. Like,
well, we know the NFL is shady AF, so that doesn't totally surprise me. But, I mean, what is this Denver Carrington football team really worth to go to these ends?
Well, it was simpler times, you know.
I think my favorite moment from this episode is multiple characters eavesdropping on each other. So we have Blake and Steven talking because Steven is finally revealing, after his dad has been in the hospital for a few weeks, that he got hitched to Sammy Joe. And of course, Blake is not happy about it, as nobody's happy about it, because Sammy Joe is a trifling little poor tramp and not fit for the Carrington name. But Blake says they're going to train her and My Fair Lady her ass and I guess make her a Carrington, because he's probably just happy that she has a vagina and not a penis, so he doesn't have to, you know, push her into a fireplace or anything. But then we have Alexis overhearing that conversation and then weirdly just out in the hallway mentions this whole thing, how Fallon's not really Blake's daughter.
Yeah, and I think it's also fun because they even do some sort of like a trope on eavesdropping with Blake's blindness, because like there's all these like moments where Blake's not sure who's in the room and whoever is in the room is sort of like observing him and sort of like seeing or observing
a little bit, but I wish they would have gone further with that.
Yeah, I guess, you know, they could have done more with that, but they at least went there with it. Like, you know, like you had like what, Crystal in his office kind of watching him as he says like, call my wife, you know, and he thinks it's the secretary, and then he's like, never mind, don't, you know, and then she's like, oh,
Blake,
but it's me, Blake.
I'm here.
Right. So it's like sort of like, oh, what was his intention? You know, like, did he have second thoughts? Like, what is his real feeling for his wife at this moment? And
well, he says it. He wants to get fucked.
Well, that's essentially how it plays out.
Crystal, I want you to know this just in case you don't. I can get hundreds of people to bring me a cup of coffee. I can snap my fingers and have a table set for 200 people. I can pick up the phone and I can have a government in South America fall. Those are not the things that I need a wife for. I need a wife in my bed. Now, is that what you're offering?
People aren't really taking advantage, I guess, to their credit, of his blindness, because a lot of people could be using this to their advantage and listening in on all of Blake's little nefarious conversations. But I don't feel like anybody's really doing that. I think they, you know, Crystal eventually says, Blake, it's me, not your secretary. And then Alexis goes in and has a conversation with him. But it was just funny because Alexis overhears Steven and Blake talking, and then Alexis and Steven are talking and Sammy Joe overhears them. I wanted somebody else to overhear Sammy Joe.
Yeah, there's
and Steven
a lot of iterations
talking.
Of overhearing.
Yeah, it's like we could just go the whole episode of people listening in on each
Which
other.
In some ways is kind of very meta, because like this whole idea of eavesdropping is very old fashioned soap opera, you know, cliche.
Yeah, but you were sort of hinting at it before, and the last episode it really took a turn that Sammy Joe is in this for the money, honey.
Well, I'm glad that she's like finally showing her fangs now, because mm-hmm. like before, like, and I agree with you guys, the prior episode she was sort of very believable up until that, and now it's like quite clear, like, oh, this is what you're really dealing with this character. Like, yeah, she's just there for the money.
Right. Well, and now that she's overheard this bit of information about Fallon, who has, of course, not been nice to Sammy Joe, clearly she's going to try to use that in her favor, because Sammy Joe is just not getting what she wants. She's been sort of put to the back burner, and she thought hitched she was going to be
the
star of the
show.
Yeah, I'm not
going to pretend. There's a lot of reasons to hate Sammy Joe, and I buy it. I buy into it full for. I cannot stand her, and this is like one of the big like cleats that she gets in the field here, where this is like.
Excuse me, did you just use a sports metaphor?
Yeah, I don't know. Sammy Joe's like got a 5/8 socket wrench, you know, changing spark plugs in the Trans Am. So, I mean, the roles are all reversed tonight, apparently. But no.
What are you saying? Women can't be mechanics?
No, they can't.
You're canceled.
No, they can put air in tires. You. That's it. And bring me a beer. No, but like, the thing with her character is that now she's like decided that she's going to play everybody against everybody in this family. And I think it's, you know, it makes her a very easy to hate character, but it's what's kind of fun about Sammy Joe, I guess.
Yeah, I don't hate her. I don't hate her yet. I mean, maybe I will, but I'm reserving judgment because I'm still feeling out what she wants.
I hate her because Steven is not bisexual, and I don't understand this whole thing with him marrying her. That's what I hate about
darling, her. I already explained to you he loves race car driving, so she's just this cipher for race car driving.
A woman and a timing gun a heterosexual relationship does not make.
Yeah, I know, it's a stretch. Well, Cecil Colby's back. That's good. We hadn't seen him for a little while, and we love Cecil Colby. He's all into this whole oil shale, which I had to Google oil shale because I didn't know what the fuck oil shale was. I guess it's a special kind of rock.
Well, let's just get down to brass tacks with him. He kind of like blew his cover with Claudia and stops by her new larger cubicle than the one she had before.
Yeah, she really is on the fast track.
Oh, she's moving on up.
She's going to be like vice president of sexual relations at Denver Carrington by the next episode.
Okay, that was really good. I want to know more about that. Instead of the Colbys, can we have a sideshow about that? And like
Claudia. It'll just be called Claudia.
Yeah, it's really sad because like she's still giving this character her all, and like they're not giving her much to work
they're
with.
Giving her literally one scene every episode.
and yet like I'm still just like stunned by the quality of her acting in this very very minor part at this point.
You are such a Claudia stan.
No, I'm a Pamela Bellwood stan, and the thing is like if Cecil pretty much like totally, you know, blows his whole cover about,
oh, he fucked up. Yeah, majorly.
Like he thought he was gonna keep getting intel out of her, and then like come to find out he's
lying
to her this whole time about where Matthew and Lindsay are.
Well, it's kind of racist because he's like, they were in Peru, and she's like, you said they were in Venezuela, and he was like, well yeah, Venezuela and then Peru and then Argentina. Like he doesn't know
Central
any
America?
Of the South America. He doesn't know any of those countries whatsoever. Mexico, Costa Rica, Tahiti. Yeah, I don't know. So that's racist. And then he's like misogynistic because he's like, well, you must have forgot, you know, you silly girl. You must have forgot I told you. And she's like, I never forget. I'm a mother. You said they were in Venezuela.
I mean, it's almost that bad, right? Like, I did like that she was very assertive and that she's like, that's not the kind of thing I would forget.
I wouldn't forget that. And fuck you for trying to Men in Black me.
Because again, this is like Claudia's bone right now. This is all she's caring about is Matthew and Lindsay and their whereabouts.
Well, that's all the writers have given her to care about other than her new career path. But I like that as a counterpoint to what's going on with Dr. Nicholas Toscani and Crystal. It's nice to see a woman stand up for herself to a man in power.
Yeah, you know, I like to compare. You know, that's a fun parallel I hadn't thought about. Like when you look at Claudia and Cecil versus Dr. Nick and, well, whatever woman he's involved with, depending on which scene we're talking about.
True.
Like, I'm into their thing a lot more. And, like, Claudia
does not
seem
like... Yeah, well, but unfortunately,
like,
we only get one scene
of
that.
Like, you have
and then
so
we have
to
sit
with.
Through multiple scenes of Crystal and Nick and Fallon and Nick, and then him just treating these women like they're complete imbeciles.
Dr. Nick is this trash can that Crystal and Fallon are just keep throwing themselves into, and meanwhile Claudia's got nothing to work with and having this like one little teeny tiny bite-sized morsel of an amazing scene.
Luckily we finally get Alexis having a hot take on Dr. Nick when they're at the St. Denis Club. She sees totally through it, and she warns Fallon. Well, first of all, she figures out right away that this is the guy that Fallon was fucking with.
I love this scene because it calls back to her consulting with the tarot card reader or the fortune teller or whatever. Like Alexis, again, she works very much on instinct and on maybe even the supernatural. I don't know. I think based on some of the outfits she wore in this episode, that's very possible. But like, she clearly works on this other level that like Blake does not. You know, Blake is very cut and dry and factual.
Well,
and
I'm waiting for your sort of English major comparison to come out, because her whole thing was she said, I looked into his eyes and and I could see that he's dangerous.
Well, this is okay. So this
and
is,
then you've
yeah.
got Blake.
This is who yeah. doesn't no, 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 have no, no. This is definitely part of what I was saying earlier about how all these characters keep like spitting out these lines that like.
Well, but this doesn't
are almost
actually
like
have...
cheesy references to Blake being blind. It's like I see you, I don't see you. I can see things, and it's like, but the whole time you're thinking, like, but Blake can't see. You know, but yes, no, this she's
but I just love that the writers give her that sort of insight because, yeah, he does seem suspicious. Like James Ferrantino, the actor that plays Dr. Nick, he is kind of giving a wink wink here and there, you know, especially when he talks to Blake.
You know what it is? His eyes are too close together.
No, that's not what it is. It's acting. It's the way he delivers the lines. There is something else going on. And I think he does, the actor James Ferrantino does a great job of delivering that. Because we know, because he knows, we know there's a, you know, body hanging around that he sees in flashes.
The body
sometimes.
Just keeps swinging.
It's, yeah, it's still hung up there. It hasn't fallen off yet.
Man who expects his money and power to buy him everything, including his sight.
He's Blake Carrington. He's what and who he is. He's my husband.
Whom you don't sleep with anymore.
That's none of your business. Nick, I have to stay with him for now.
Why? Because he's blind.
Because he needs the emotional support. You know that.
Tell me something. Who the hell has nailed you to this cross? Not his ex-wife. Certainly not his daughter.
I'll leave him when he can see.
I just think Crystal is like in her classic snare that she keeps trapping herself in these situations where she has emotions that she can't act upon and she won't make a commitment. Here she is like smooching Dr. Toscani again, but like, oh, we've have to, you know, cut this off and I'm Blake's wife.
Well, I want to stand up for this character because Linda Evans is so freaking likable. But my God, she's a fucking moron. Why does she keep getting involved with this guy? Why
I'm
does
blame
she,
the writers for this.
Why
one.
Does she put her fur coat on and drive over to his house? Like
she could have just called him and said all this stuff.
She said multiple times now, like more than three times, that she's not interested in him. So why does she keep going back to him? It's infuriating.
I mean, maybe she was just like, I don't know, she got her nails done and she was bored driving home and thought she'd stop by Dr. Nick's, which is always like a big mistake, huge.
I'm going to like pull a blind Blake Carrington and I'm going to start flipping over furniture and throwing vases at the wall. And you know what? Then I'm going to get a special Senate Security Commission or whatever his weird ass plan
Crime
is.
Crime Stoppers or whatever this is.
Yeah. I'm going to call 1-800 Crime Stoppers. What is his plan here? This doesn't make any sense to me.
It's pretty dumb. I don't, you know, and I'm just thinking like, oh, it must be nice to be like ultra wealthy and just get the Senate on your side. What the hell is that? Like,
And he
can't even call my credit card company and dispute a charge and like expect any kind of recourse. Like, and this guy's got like the whole Colorado State Senate on his behalf.
Well, I'm
like,
waiting for everybody to laugh in his face, ha, huh, because he's never met this Rhinewood guy, doesn't know what he looks like. How did he even know to sell half of the team to bail him out anyway? Like, how did he figure who this person
well, we,
out
we did get a little justice there because yeah the lieutenant even kind of like victim shames Blake over that, like, well, have you seen this guy? Do you even know what he looks like? Do you even know he's real?
Yeah,
like,
they had no information, no license plate.
So you deserved it, dude.
Yeah, I did like that. I mean, I do like this whole idea that Blake is suffering because he's made so many people suffer for the first season and a half of this show, so he kind of deserves it.
Yeah, but it's interesting because this character has kind of like thawed out, you know, like he was so severe in the first half of the first season. And then like this last few episodes, he seems like a little bit more, you know.
Well, him apologizing to Joseph the bitchy butler was like,
yeah,
had me quaking in my boots. I can't believe that he did that. He was being so nasty to him, yanking on that bell or whatever to get him to come in. Of course, you know, your theory that Joseph the bitchy butler has the hots for Blake is got a lot more evidence this episode because Joseph is like coming to Blake's side in the middle of the night, and now he wants to
reading him spy novels.
Yeah, they're having like a little romantic reading moment, and Joseph's like, I'm gonna just set up a bed next to yours and I'm just gonna watch you sleep all night.
That is classic stalker gay boyfriend or gay straight boyfriend stuff. Like, yeah.
I am sorry, but I do not. If I need help, you can still sleep in the next room over. Actually, I have a question. So Blake is blind. He has trouble going up and down steps. The Carrington Mansion famously has a big ass staircase, probably the biggest in Denver. Are there no bedrooms on the ground floor? Why do we have to have this poor old man going up and down the steps?
You think he would put up with that? No, he does not want to be coddled to, and that's the whole point. And that's why I think it's interesting that the one person he lets coddle him is Joseph, not his wife.
He probably does a lot more
Alexis,
than coddle.
Not even really his daughter, Fallon. Like he just only Joseph. Like his, you know, it's like this is like some My Man Godfrey stuff. Like, so yeah, I just think all that's very interesting and subtextual.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, he definitely ate his words when he was being all nasty to Joseph, and I'm surprised they didn't kiss and make up.
They did. That just didn't make it to the final cut.
Oh, I'm going to have to look on the DVD extras for that. Well, are you excited that Alexis and Fallon are teaming up now that Fallon has figured out that Crystal is indeed having some sort of a non-professional relationship with Dr. Nicholas Toscani?
Well, you know, it's the old idea, the enemy of your enemy is your friend or whatever, right? So, like, clearly they're going to forge a small... we'll see how effective alliance over this whole hoopla with Crystal and Dr. Nick. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, Fallon is a very flawed character, perhaps more flawed than Alexis. And as far as mothers and daughters go, like, I just, you know, the two of them just don't gel.
Yeah.
Out of the cards,
well,
you know?
And I think that Alexis is going to be more thoughtful about this whole thing where Fallon, for some reason, her pussy just gets so wet for Dr. Nick that she makes dumb decisions. So I'm not super confident in this alliance to get Crystal and Dr. Nick and then to take back over the Carrington family. But we'll see. Maybe it'll work. I don't know. Well, we've refilled our champagne glasses and it's time to talk about our lurks of the week. Kyler, what was yours?
Well, I'm just going straight in for the jugular. You know what I'm after here. It's it's Alexis, and she's looking wicked.
She's looking wicked.
Well, I do have to say she's got a couple of outfits that specifically feature peak shoulders. So, like, she's now getting the power shoulder treatment pretty much in most of her, if not all of her, costumes at this stage of the game. She's in this black number, and it's this amazing, like, I don't know what this gold piping is. It's not fabric. It's like, it's almost like gold PVC. I don't know. It's extraordinarily shiny.
Yeah.
And I'm like a parrot on that. Like, I just want to chew the shininess. And it's got the high collar with the Victorian reference to it, and she's got the updo and the tendrils, which, you know, heretofore we're used to her in like the 70s disco hair, and not so severe looking with the clothes. So this is an amazing outfit. I, you know, and it's got the dark the black opaque stockings. Rounded toe, suede black high heel pump. It's just, it's, and you know, like, look, there's nothing amazing in the overall impact of it, but it's just a great dress with some nice detailing. And
I really liked it, but it felt like, and you know, it's been Halloween season the past few weeks, it felt very costumey Halloween, like. I felt like it needed one touch where it was
the
80s. To me, this was just like such a throwback. It wasn't modern.
I think this is another example of like how costume her character is, though. And I think there was this interesting accessory, you may call it. She's like walking around with an antique leather-bound book. So it was just like, I think part of the look, even though it may not be on purpose. So it's just,
oh, well, that's
very Bell Book and Candle.
No, no, no. That it's exactly, which is why I didn't like it, because that's not 80s to me. We're supposed to be in 82 here.
Well,
but no, the book I loved, because to me, I'm just thinking back on the set that day. Alexis is like, well, why am I in the house right now? Oh, maybe I just came into the library to grab a book. And so, you know, that's what Joan was doing. You know, she's very method in that way. So she's like, I'm going to walk around with this book. Even though we don't talk about it, it's not referenced in the script, but this is why Alexis is walking around the Carrington Mansion right now, eavesdropping on people.
Yeah, you know, she's so with her
snaps to
Thackeray
to Joan,
or whatever it is she's reading, you know.
Well, my lurk of the week is basically a counterpoint, I think, to that. We have the darkness, the evil witchy magic, and then we have the light, the angel that is Crystal Carrington in this all white ensemble. And she's wearing it actually, I think, a little bit earlier in the episode, but she's got a fur coat on top of it, so you can't really see much of it. It's not until later when she's serving.
Yeah, that's sort of like the ranch dressing on top of everything.
Mmm, yum, yum. Can I have extra ranch with my order? But no, I think it's great. She's wearing her hair up for most of the episode, which is an interesting choice. But this has the collar that goes all the way up the neck. This one's got the shoulders. It's very much the same sort of silhouette thing that Alexis has going on with her black outfit.
True.
But to me, this is the better version because it's silky.
If you notice, the silk blouse material, it has a sort of Glen plaid embossed into it. Like,
yeah,
a texture.
There's like a pattern.
Yeah, and so I don't know. There's a lot of detail there. And I do like the her updo is very like Gibson Girl 1901 post-Victorian, which we don't really get her in another hairstyle. Like, this is kind of
we only get her in two hairstyles.
You get the haystack.
You get it up or you get the barn door.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's like nice to see her in that hairdo. And then like with the fur coat on top, I agree. And by the way, that fur coat is the perfect length. It's like mid-calf. So it's very long and statement.
And great boots to go with the white boots that go with the outfit. So, no, I think she was edging her out. And this is, to me, very 80s, very contemporary for the time. And angelic.
Well,
as
it's very 80s, but like woman of means, you know, like.
Well, we are watching Dynasty. Yeah. This is a show about
I'm
people
just
of means.
Making that distinction. This is not the merry-go-round.
And I just want to give a quick honorable mention to attorney Andrew Laird's Sunday outfit.
You were such a hooker for that.
What, the whole Richard Burton realness?
Oh, don't think you're going to get me with Richard Burton.
Turtleneck and a blazer, that's a Burton look through and through. But in this instance, Andy Laird has like a baby blue turtleneck, and then he even paired it with a
little baby blue hanky.
Yeah. So I just love that he stopped by to see his pal,
well,
Blake
then I
Carrington.
Guess we have to honorably mention Blake Carrington's West Side of Los Angeles disco record producer look with the windshield dark sunglasses.
Well, for me, those glasses to me is just Tony Stark, like Robert Downey Jr. He wears those glasses in all of them damn Iron Man movies. So every time he kept putting his one blind mice glasses on, I just kept thinking, oh, Mr. Stark, I don't feel so good.
Also, I mean, we already know this best ass goes to Heather Locklear bending over the Trans Am again.
Yeah, but you know, second place close behind is Stephen Carrington. They've only been married like a week or two, and they're already dressing alike, and their hair is alike, and their asses are alike.
We've already said that they have the same damn hairdo. But
well, there's another reason right there for you that Stephen is into Sammy Joe. It's like a lot of gay men like date or marry guys that are look exactly like them.
Yeah, she's in a strange way a funhouse mirror image of Steven.
Her ass is better though, for sure. Well, that's another episode of Dynasty As They Want to Be in the books. Thank you so much for listening. If you liked this episode, rate us on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you can rate podcasts. Give us 5 stars and write a review if you want. And if you're blind and you can't write, then, you know, have your butler do it for you. Kyler, thank you so much for joining me. I'm glad to have you back.
We'll talk. We'll see.
I'm glad you didn't quit the podcast. And also thank you to Lindsay Mound, the artist who designed our logo, and DJ Jugo, who did our amazing theme song. We had a fun tweet since we last checked our social media. Brian Stevens, at TSARBrian, sent a fun pic on Twitter of him on a cruise. I think he was on the TCM Turner Classic Movie cruise, which sounds like the best time ever.
Do they just play like All About Eve on nonstop rotation?
He wrote, getting in the proper frame of mind to listen to my favorite podcast, at Nasty Podcast. It's a picture of Brian on the deck of the ship. I think it's aft. Yeah, that's aft because that's the back of the ship. Wearing a t-shirt with a caricature of Alexis Carrington. It looks like one of those Glenn Hansen caricatures, but it could be another artist. I'm not sure. Let us know, Brian. But yeah, he's looking fabulous. And we're so happy that Dynasty is They Want to Be is your favorite podcast.
Love, exciting and new. Come aboard. We're expecting you.
It's the
Love Boat.
I was going to say Dynasty Boat.
Dynasty Boat? What the fuck is that?
I don't know. Why aren't there any boats on this show?
You mean yachts?
If you want to tweet us from a cruise, you can do so. We're at Nasty Podcast. That's NASTY Podcast on Twitter, Instagram. We'd love to hear from you and know that we're your favorite podcast. Bye.